You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on 10th of December 2011 on Monocle 24. The Review is brought to you in association with J.Crew.
Hello and welcome to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brûlé, and Gillian DeBias.
Ahead in the next hour, we hear about the best music up north. The Nordic Music Prize 2011 has revealed 10 candidates for Best Album of the Year. We have a music expert from Norway telling us about his Nordic favourites.
And once again, as ever, we'll be touring bookshops around the world. This week, we travel to Taipei, Thessaloniki, and Miami.
We have each year about 600 to 700 author events. Just recently, we had the basketball player Shaquille O'Neal. 2 days before that, we had Bill Clinton.
That was Mitchell Kaplan, owner of Books in Books in Miami.
And joining us around our studio table for our weekly magazine review will be Jane Morris, editor of The Art newspaper.
All that and much more right here on The Review, right here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House in London with me, Tyler Brûlé and Gillian DeBias. Hello.
Good morning, Tyler. How are you?
I feel that every time we venture into the studio on a Saturday of late in London, it's always a gorgeous day outside.
I know, which is so unusual, but it's that perfect pre-Christmas, crispy, yeah, frosty day, which is such a treat.
No, absolutely. And it was, I was walking here up Children's Street, and as you were commenting as well, it's just all the holly bushes are out, and it's great.
And amazingly, because Chiltern Street is known for its wedding dresses, and I don't associate with winter, but there are all these brides trying on these winter wedding dresses.
Oh, really?
This morning. So I guess I'm looking in, poking, giving them the thumbs up. It's quite cute.
Just a quick look at the papers, just two stories. I don't know if you saw this morning, but in the Financial Times, they're talking about Mary Portis's review on town centre policies. And for those who are not familiar with Mary Portis, very famous as visual merchandising doyenne.
Mary Queen of Shops.
Mary Queen of Shops, yeah. So first, you know, a very sort of, you know, famous life at Harvey Nichols, and then a very successful TV series. And so, you know, I guess if czars or czarinas are sort of the fashion of the moment, the current government in the UK has appointed her to look at town centres. So what the FT is saying this morning is that her report is going to be coming out next week. And, you know, one thing might be looking at this time when, of course, stores are really struggling. I mean, if I look at, you know, how early, again, the sale started in this country, it's incredible.
The shop windows, I mean, should be full of Christmas decorations and the big red sale signs.
I don't know if you heard my commentary this week as well. I said it's so sad as well that, you know, everyone has just got these, like, you know, slash prices. And there's no sense of Christmas fantasy in windows at all anymore. So it's quite sad. Anyway, they're saying in this piece that it looks like you know, they will potentially, you know, get past with this 3-year moratorium on out-of-town shops, so sort of no box stores.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, London always maybe is the flagship city where it has some good windows, but you leave London and it's frightening. It's scary, especially
and,
the high streets.
It's just looking at all of the papers as well, my God, you can tell it's Christmas because the sheer amount of watch advertising is remarkable. But when you get to the business section of the Herald Tribune this morning, very interesting story. Headline is "Ruling Could Gum Up Watchworks," and it talks about how the Swatch Group from January 1st are going to, you know, cut back, and I mean almost they can sort of fully curtail their supply of implements, because aside from just making their own watches, they make implements and they sell them on to their competitors, etc. So there's a picture of a gentleman, Alexandre Strambini, of the watch company Edox, and he just said, you know, these smaller players, they rely on someone like the Swatch Group to buy their parts from, and so they said this could potentially be one of the biggest upheavals to the watch business, since the Japanese introduced digital watches back in the 1970s and 80s. And do you have anything else to know?
Well, I was looking through the papers. First of all, I couldn't help but looking at the French because of the whole Eurozone crisis, and I just love their headlines: "L'Europe à 25, c'est fini," and then of course, "La Grande Bretagne plus insulaire que jamais."
I mean, what else would Le Monde have on its front cover this morning?
Exactly.
I guess we should
shuffle along. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. In a moment, we hear from independent booksellers about the titles doing particularly well in their part of the world after this.
And indeed you are with a review here on Monocle 24, where it's time to hear what booksellers are selling around the world. That, of course, be independent bookshops.
So we sent our correspondents to their locals in Thessaloniki, Taipei and Miami. And first we hear to Thessaloniki.
I'm Kostis Karadzas, Executive VP of Yanos, a Greek culture chain. Yanos was founded in 1984 by my father, Nikos Karadzas, here in Thessaloniki. And it started as a bookstore, an art gallery and a publishing house. It has evolved in these years, and we are now a broader culture chain. We sell art objects, stationery, and more. And at the same time, we offer other services such as events, organization, publishing house, as I said, digital media, and more. The hits of the past week have been some calendars that just came out and they are hot now. It's the new book of Victoria Hislop, Tonima in Greek, or The Thread. Also a new edition of Le Petit Nicolas for children. It's the new book of Schopenhauer, The Art of Being Always Right. And also a couple of books published for a series of competitions that we run for younger people. One was a photography competition and one was a novel. In the following period, we are expecting a lot of children's books for Christmas, of course, as always this time of the year. We are also expecting a couple of books we think that they're going to sell a lot. One is the new book of Philip Roth, and also the book of Marilyn Yalom, A History of the Wife. But at the same time, we're expecting further down the road a lot of titles about our city, Thessaloniki, which celebrates the 100 years of its liberation in 2012.
That was Nikos Karatsas from Inos Bookshop in Thessaloniki.
I was just going to say, you would have thought that there would have been more books on it. I was thinking sort of titles like, you know, How to Make It on Your Own in the World as Greece, or How to Start Your Own Business, or How to Sustain Your Country.
I think this
Treading
is
Water.
This is an ostrich bookshop with their head in the sand.
I was going to say, they're very focused on like their children's books and sort of, you know, I like the idea that he said, you know, yeah, we've got a lot of calendars. I was like, right, okay, yeah, just counting the days. We're going to head over to Taiwan now to a bookshop in Taipei.
I am Chen Sang Wu. I open a bookstore to let the people easy to get the books about Taiwan. So we call it Taiwan's bookstore. And most of his book is the Chai Ing-wen autobiography. She is the party chairman of opposition party of Taiwan, DDP parties. People swap in, want to get her books to read it, to know about her. Our people quite curious about the small, little, and very common lady have so many ability to do things. So she was picked as the DDP candidate to fight for the presidency. That's why her autobiography is so popular and people wanted to know about her.
And that was Cheng San Wu from Taiwan's shop, bookshop in Taipei. You've been to Taipei, haven't you?
No,
oh, you haven't
yet.
Been.
No, not yet. And you?
Yes, I've been many times. I'm a huge fan of Taipei. I could
really.
I got a sense of that shop just listening to him, because they're very, very good at tiny shop fronts and great little tea shops. And it's very, very different, I think, from, you know, when you go to Hong Kong. I mean, of course, you know, Hong Kong has a small shop culture, but I think it's always sort of in the shadow of sort of, you know, the big towers. And Taipei is actually quite, even though, of course, it's got, you know, buildings like Taipei 101, it's actually quite a low-rise city as well. So it's got that, has more of that intimacy of when you're in a Japanese city like Osaka or in Tokyo.
I loved in Shanghai, they had a tradition of secondhand bookshops. Do they have secondhand bookshops in Taipei?
Yeah, there's a lot of secondhand bookshops, but just, you know, but great galleries. And but I don't know, there's a wonderful tradition of the shopkeeper. We should go to Miami. Actually, I know this bookshop very well. Let's see what Mitchell Kaplan has to say.
I'm Mitchell Kaplan, the owner of Books and Books in South Florida. We are standing now in our Carl Gables store, We have two other stores as well in South Florida, one on Lincoln Road and one in the Bal Harbour Shops. This is our kind of flagship store in Coral Gables. It's a beautiful store built around a courtyard in an old Mediterranean-style building, which is on the historic register as well. And when you walk into our store, the first thing you see is basically kind of like a newsstand in a courtyard. And this helps draw people in from the sidewalks. And then we have a bar. We have a beer and wine license. At night we have music. And we have a full-blown cafe that also operates out of our courtyard. But then when you walk into the store, if you come in on the west side, you're greeted with what we call the New and Notable Room. This is where we have the Indie Bound bestsellers. Indie Bound is a program of the American Booksellers Association, where over 2,000 independent bookstores come together and give their bestsellers. And some of the bestsellers on the list, which are probably a little different than the traditional bestsellers. And so on this list, you see, for instance, Joan Didion's Blue Nights, very high up on the list. You also see Murakami's new novel, very high up on the list. The other thing you have when you walk into the store, two books that we've published here at Books and Books that are kind of cool. One is called Blue Christmas. The subtitle is Holiday Stories for the Rest of Us. They're non-sentimental, dark short stories, original short stories, written by very well-known authors like Robert Gulrich, Anne Hood, Jane Hamilton, Steve Almond. And this is one of two books that we at Books and Books have published. And then as you walk in, you can see that in our windows, being that this is holiday time, we have gift books that are particular to South Florida. We have two marvelous books on Cuba and Havana. One is called The Splendor of Cuba, which is a tremendous, beautiful book on Cuban architecture. The other is The Great Houses of Havana, which is just that. It's all of the great, large, beautiful houses. We also have a history of Def Jam Recordings, which was put together by two of the early employees of Def Jam. These books happen to be signed. For the holiday season, we bring out all the books that people had signed who had come, because we think those make really kind of interesting gifts as well. We have each year about 600 to 700 author events in the store, things like readings and demonstrations. Just recently, we had the basketball player Shaquille O'Neal was here. 2 days before that, we had Bill Clinton. So we have a pretty interesting group of people who come to the store.
That was Mitchell Kaplan, owner of Books and Books in Miami. And what a great voice. He should be a DJ for us.
Exactly. And it's, as I was saying in the intro, it's a wonderful bookshop. You sort of meander around through all of these great rooms. And again, it's a store which has, really stood in the face of the huge, box stores that, of course, dot Florida.
I love the fact that they publish their own books as well. I think it's brilliant.
They're also one of the ones, because, he was referring to the one in Coral Gables, sort of also very, very opposite in many ways in terms of just the way the neighborhood is set up from South Beach, but quite a cozy area. Of course, we're going to be moving from books to music right after our short break. We're going to be heading off to see what's happening with the Nordic music scene with the Nordic Music Prize 2011.
J. Crew is thrilled to be shipping across the pond to our customers in the UK. Shop our famous collection of colourful cashmere and wardrobe staples for men, women and children. At J. Crew, you can always expect impeccable quality, design integrity and flawless customer service every time you shop. Visit jcrew.com for the full story.
We have 7 Monocle shops around the world, in London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Osaka, and 2 in Tokyo, where you can find a full range of Monocle products perfect for a Christmas gift for your loved ones. We're now carrying the latest in Monocle collaborations, including Drake's winter gloves and scarves, Anderson sailor sweaters, Velextra grip wallets, Todd's passport holders, and of course, the Monocle 24 Revo radio, so you can listen to us in high fidelity sound. So at home or away, drop by a Monocle shop. We'd love to show you around.
A And you are back here in Studio 2 at Midori House with me, Tyler Brûlé, and Gillian DeBias. You're listening to The Review right here on Monocle 24. Now it's time to head a little bit north of London, considerably further north, up to Oslo. We're going to talk to the founder of Small Town Supersound, of course, about the Nordic Music Prize.
Hello, Joachim. How are you?
Hi, I'm fine.
Good. I wanted to start. I wonder if you could tell us a bit how important is this showcase for Nordic music, and is this a vintage year?
Do you mean the Bjørn Festival or the Nordic Music Prize?
The Nordic Music Prize.
Yeah, we established it last year, and it was kind of based on the model of the UK's Mercury Prize. So the first year was really successful, and what we tried to do was to tie the Nordic countries together. There's a lot of differences between the countries, and the music scene in Sweden is not that known in Denmark, for example. So for us, was important to kind of like tie it all together and have a common face out.
And when you say the common face out, what are the common denominators, and what are the standout sounds, do you think, coming this year?
I think it's this year it's pretty good. It's I think it has this Nordic vibe to it. There's some unknown bands, totally unknown, and there's kind of more established ones like Björk and Lykke Li, and there's kind of up and coming things that like Ice Age, which is now signed to XL in London. So we kind of feel that it's we're really happy with it, and it's also kind of everything from there's hip hop and there's electronic and there's a good mixture of musical styles, so we're really happy.
Joachim, I wanted to ask you. It's interesting how you said that somehow, you know, a lot of acts, despite the proximity and of course how, you know, close the Nordic world might be diplomatically, that sometimes music is just does not cross across borders. Why is that, do you think?
It's always been like that. Okay, you can say it's a little bit wrong what I said earlier. Sweden has always had a good impact in Norway, and I think also in Denmark. But Norwegian music has had really big problems getting into the Swedish market, and Finland is kind of on the outside and not represented in any market. So it's been a little bit weird for you on the outside. Everybody thinks that kind of Scandinavia and Nordic is very much together and we speak the same languages and stuff, but it's not like that, and the borders between say Norway and Sweden, I think it's easier for us selling and promoting Norwegian music to England than to Sweden, actually.
It's when you sort of look beyond the borders of Europe, where does the Nordic sound, and I want to come back and talk about the Nordic sound in a second, but you know, where is the sort of great breakthrough for, you know, artists from Norway, you know, Sweden, Denmark, you know, etc.?
What do you mean?
In terms of what markets really sort of embrace the Nordic sound internationally? So let's say beyond Europe, where are Nordic acts doing well?
Yeah, I think that's in Japan and America, especially, and this, you know, the Icelandic music has always been pretty good, and Sweden as well. So, but especially these places, yeah.
What are the stories they're telling? What are the lyrics? Are they telling stories about their immediacy, or where are their songs coming from?
Some of these are in English, though, and that's kind of common in Scandinavia as well, that everybody sings in English. But there's also some of these bands are singing in their.
And what are they talking language. About? What are the themes coming out through the lyrics? What are the stories?
That's kind of hard to, because it's like 12 different nominees and goes everywhere, and there's even a couple of instrumental albums here. So that's it's hard to I don't think there's any red threads when it comes to lyrics, but in the music I would say there is, I guess, but that's easier for you to see, that there's kind of like a little bit dark and melancholic to the music coming from the Nordic countries, I think.
Yeah, there's a melancholy, and then I think as well there's kind of a funny, you know, bittersweet optimism as well. So I guess it's sort of, you know, it's the dark nights of winter, but of course, you know, spring is always going to come again, because I think that there's, you know, when you listen to a lot of things, and, you know, oddly, as you were saying, Joachim, there's, you know, it's very hard to even find, let's say, a lot of, you know, like more obscure Nordic acts. I mean, of course, we can all find you know, the likes of Björk and Lucky Lee, you know, in the UK. But, if you, you know, when you go to Japan, for example, it is incredible how they're so quick to pick up on so many acts. And I sort of wonder if, you know, part of the attraction, too, is that the Japanese tend to like sort of a certain amount of happiness in their music as well.
Yeah, that might be it. And I think everything is tied together with the whole Scandinavian kind of, you know, we have the design, you have the architecture, you have the weather, you have the music. I think there's everything is kind of tied together. You don't see it all the time, you know, like Finland is very good on heavy metal, and that has nothing to do with this. But you can see that, and that I think that's important for the Japanese market at least. Mm. They're very into Norwegian and Scandinavian design and architecture.
Now, we've got a song lined up. You've chosen something from Lucky Lee. Is she you know likely to do well with the awards?
Yeah, I think so. She would be one of the favorites, but also I think that you know it's you know Björk is a big name as well. But I think that the jury is from the outside. You know, we have only people from UK and US, and that's actually what we want. We want someone from the outside to see this. So I think that there could be a really unknown outsiders that can take the prize. Actually,
okay, we're going to listen to two songs, but first this is Lucky Lee with "Youth Know No Pain." And that was Lucky Lee with Youth Know No Pain. And we are talking to Joachim Haglund, who is up in Oslo with Small Town Superstar. We've been chatting about the Nordic Music Prize 2011. And Joachim, just picking up, you know, off the back of Lucky Lee, tell us about some of the other acts who you think also might be contenders. I mean, you said before we went to it, she's obviously, you know, one of the strongest. But maybe who are some of your favorites?
Yeah, I think my favorite is actually the Feel from Sweden. But that's electronic music and instrumental. They've been doing really well in electronic circles around the world. And I think also they've done one of the best albums of the year. But then also you have Anne Brun from Norway. She's both from Norway and Sweden. She's been doing really well here in Scandinavia and also has a name abroad.
Yeah, she was performing live for us here. We've been playing, I think, Andrin's on very heavy rotation on Monocle 24.
Oh yeah, okay, yeah. She's made a really, really good album. So yeah. And it's been the number one on all the polls here in Norway. Also, I think that Ice Age from Denmark is really good. They're coming up and they're really young and it's more like a punk, post-punk sound to it. Mm-hmm. And then Anna Järven, who also, she sings in Swedish and Finnish. And she's really great.
Joachim, I wanted to ask you, how do artists get sort of known and discovered? Is it through events and performing? Is it radio play? Is it online? How does the word of mouth work?
Yeah, actually, how the voting is the kind of basis that we have like a journalist in each country, and that journalist has like a small jury, and they picks out the best albums, and then they send it out to all the to a lot of media and record industry people in each country, and they vote for this, and then they bring the results back to Oslo. They meet all the five Nordic countries. They meet here and they discuss it and they listen, and then they come up with a 12. And after that, we have the main selection during the Bylarm Festival, when the prize takes place, and then the jury comes in, and it's people from have Lawrence Bell from Domino Records and Jeanette Lee from Rough Trade and Jonathan Galkin from DSA and Rob Young from The Wire and Uncut, etc. So then these people are selecting from the 12 that the Nordic jury has selected.
Joachim, just picking up on what Julian was saying, I wanted to know about radio play in the Nordic region. You know, of course, I think, the likes of Sweden and Denmark and Norway were, of course, very regulated for a long time. And it's still, one could argue, it's the power of the state broadcasters, whether it's Denmark's radio or NRK or Sveriges Radio, etc. I'm wondering, how important is radio play? Because a lot of those networks, of course, also have more alternative emerging stations. And because they're public broadcasters, there is quite a strong level of playlist support for national artists. So does radio still figure, or would you say it is more just downloads and even, let's say, independent radio outlets that have pulling power now?
It is still important, and you have to, at the Norwegian National Radio, for example, you have to play a certain amount of Norwegian music, a percentage of that, and that helps, of course, a lot. But these days, radio is also losing when it comes to blogs and all that stuff. So I think that people are more international now, and also when it comes to newspapers here in Norway, I think that people are on the blogs before they read the Norwegian newspaper. So the local power is kind of like disappearing a little bit to the blogs and the internet around the world.
Mm. Now, you mentioned one of your other favorites, Anna Järvinen. We have another song from her. This is Uppat Fromat på Finska, I believe.
Yeah. It's called... I'm not sure, actually. I think it's called... It's Up and Forward in Finnish. It's actually translated directly.
Okay, it sounds like a Finnish nationalist song. Let's have a listen. And that was Anna Järvinen with Uppat Fromat på Finska. Joachim, that wasn't the happiest song for a Saturday, but I guess it's sort of when you were talking about melancholy a little bit earlier on, it sounded like she was in a rather rainy birch forest up by Tampere or somewhere like that.
But a lovely voice.
yeah, exactly. There's something Bergmanish over that song, I think.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Is all of Anna Järvinen's sound like that?
Yeah, it does, but it is really powerful, and she's done really good albums. So, but she sings in Swedish, so she hasn't had a big name abroad. But I think that she can do that. Her backing band is actually the same backing band as Dungen, which is also singing in Swedish, but is doing very well, and they were nominated last year. So there is hope for exporting music, although we sing in our native language.
Absolutely. Well, listen, we're very intrigued to see what happens, and I'm sure we're going to be checking in with you again.
Yeah, I hope so.
Okay, wonderful. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That was Joachim Höglund from Small Town Supersound. You are listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. Up next, we are going to have our review of the best in periodicals right here. Back after this.
J. Crew is thrilled to be shipping across the pond to our customers in the UK. Shop our famous collection of colourful cashmere and wardrobe staples for men, women and children. At J. Crew, you can always expect impeccable quality, design integrity and flawless customer service every time you shop. Visit jcrew.com for the full story.
This Christmas, why not give the gift of Monocle? A Monocle subscription spreads happiness and cheer throughout the year. Our special gift subscription is for only the most deserving recipients. The first issue comes hand-wrapped in Monocle design paper with an accompanying welcome letter which announces your gift and a personal message should you so wish. Subscribe now and we'll also send the new exclusive tote bag for 2011 with the first few issues. Our 12-month gift subscription costs £80 sterling, including magazine delivery costs to anywhere in the world. The recipient of your gift will receive 10 issues of the magazine and also 12 months access to all of our online content at monocle.com. So whether they've been naughty or nice, why not give them the gift of Monocle?
And you're back in Studio One here at Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé and Julian Debye. This is The Review here from London. Right now we've got, I've just seen a rather large stack of magazines come into the studio with Jane Morris, the editor of the Art newspaper. I was going to say good morning, good afternoon and welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
You know, I want the Art newspaper to go broader, not in format, but because I love the format so much. I just wish there was a daily newspaper covering the entire world, because I just the paper, and you know, I think if anyone right now is doing something interesting and even sort of relevant in print, it's the way this comes out and feels. I just think it's just wonderful always getting this in your hands.
Thank you very much. I mean, I have to say, I think some of us would if you had a sort of infinite budget and infinite number of staff, I think a lot of us would actually like to do something daily, because one of the big challenges for us always is, monthly newspaper. It's a bit of a contradiction in terms.
Right.
We have to try and make sure as many of our stories are exclusive as possible. And I cannot tell you through the month how many stories that we did have 3 or 4 days, maybe a week before everybody else. And then it gets printed somewhere, whether it's in the New York Times, which we consider a great rival, or the Times in London. It gets published and we're all cursing and gnashing our teeth.
Jane, is there more or less competition? Let's speak with English language first, but is there more or less competition in this field now? I mean, and I'm going to put sort of, what happens, digitally, blogs aside, but even it seems like there's just been a proliferation of, more specialist magazines in the art territory in the broadest sense.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. And as the contemporary art market has grown, crazily since the early 2000s, obviously, a lot of people see that there's a niche there, or they think there's a niche there. So there's a huge proliferation of magazines. But there aren't very many doing what I would consider proper news journalism, proper investigative, sticking your nose into corners that people don't want you to stick your nose into, and asking why is X, like X, and why is Y, why should that be so?
Give us some examples for people who are listening internationally who may not be familiar with the Art newspaper. When you talk about that type of journalism, what type of stories would you be breaking? And as you said, you're gnashing your teeth if some people beat you to it. What type of journalism is it?
Okay, well, I mean, the lead story on the December issue, which then follows through the paper, is really looking at an issue which may seem a little dry and specialist, but basically is about the fact that the ability of collectors and dealers to use libel and other laws to stop you saying that a work of art might be fake is actually quite damaging to scholarship, to art history, because art history is made by a consensus of scholars and people doing research and saying, yes, this work by Henry Moore is a Henry Moore, or this work by Francis Bacon is a Francis Bacon. One of the examples we've used, and I will have to be slightly careful how I frame this, is some Bacon drawings that have come on the market in Italy, which I think there are questions to be asked about them. And the fact that we can't discuss that very freely, just like there is a set of Degas sculptures that are travelling the world from a recently found set of casts that have been cast from a set of plasters. Again, the Degas scholars don't want to discuss this.
What about your sort of journalists around the world? Like, where are your centres now for getting good stories?
Okay, we have offices in London and New York, and there is no doubt that London and New York remain very important centres for the art world. So does Germany. But we've been building up over the years. We have correspondents in India, in Russia, in China. We've been putting a lot of effort into China. We try to be truly international. It's quite difficult because, again, finding this kind of journalism isn't that easy. And we're always competing with national papers. So.
Right. On that note, if you could break down your core, constituents who read, how much of it would be, the gallery owner operator or someone who's really running the floor in the gallery versus, a collector's base?
That's, again, slightly tricky. We've done quite a lot of research in this field.
Yeah, don't believe research when it comes to reading. I don't. I mean, you can never ask me who reads our magazine either.
But the reason I'm hesitant is because some people class themselves so many different ways. The single group in the last research we had, the single biggest group was artists, which I found really, really surprising. And I think that the question has been asked in a slightly odd way,
right,
to get that result. we have a very large readership amongst collectors. I would say, though, that we do consider ourselves a trade. I mean, I think perhaps hopefully a slightly glorified trade, but we're a trade, which means we're read by museum directors, we're read by gallery owners, auction houses, and we're definitely read by collectors.
Do you think that it's a case of offering, I'm wondering how much of it is offering reporting, and that let's say the collectors are coming to you for reporting, or how much of it also is direction when you read the art newspaper as well?
What do you mean by that?
Saying in terms of sort of channel, I mean, obviously there are stories that you're covering, but I'm wondering, you know, how much are people sort of gleaning, not just the trends in the marketplace, but they sort of feel that there's a narrative and there's an editorial that also pushes them in a certain direction, to whether that's a gallery or to obviously, you know, established or emerging talent.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that we wouldn't be pushing people towards particular galleries, but we would certainly, I hope, be discussing trends that we think people ought to be thinking about.
Talking of trends, December, January, it's always interesting to see what the big topics are going to be in 2012. What are the things you're watching and want to kind of uncover next year, do you think?
I think one of the big things we're looking at in terms of, let's just say, the market, and I must admit, we talk about the market a lot, and actually we cover a lot more than the market, but one of the things we're really looking at is the growth of these super galleries and how they are pricing and promoting artists, what kind of art they are promoting.
So in terms of super galleries, give us some examples.
We mean the White Cubes and the Hauser and Wirth and the Gagosians, the people who are opening multiple brand galleries and are trying to create branded artists.
We're here with Jane Morris, editor of the art newspaper. Jane, you've got a couple of magazines here for this last little segment. What's caught your eyes in the press this month or this week?
Well, I suppose one of the things that's caught me is a piece in Newsweek by Blake Gopnik, a very respected critic at the Washington Post, who has written an interesting piece about why art is as expensive as it is. And it's a very good introductory guide. It's the edition December the 12th. But he's also done something which very few people do, which is he's done a little box called Beware the Overpriced Artist, in which he's named a few names. And the names he's named are Neo Rauch, Richard Prince, Damien Hirst, John Curran, and Wangechi Mutu. And I think it's a very interesting selection. And he's really saying it only takes a very few people to make a market. Will these artists still hold their value and be valued in 50 and 100 years' time? So I think that's well worth reading for anyone who's wondering about whether it really is worth spending $2 million on a picture.
And do you think the fact that that appeared in Newsweek, will it affect their prices and their gallery's prices of selling them?
I would say that probably not, actually. The art world is a very, very small, tightly wound group of people. He actually says in this, he talks about the fact that Ronald Lauder paid allegedly $135 million for a Klimt. We only have Ronald Lauder's kind of word for that, that he paid for a Klimt. And interestingly, Ronald Lauder features in two or three of the other magazines that are in front of me. There's a major interview in Apollo. He's one of the power collectors in Art and Auction. I suspect that Neo Rauch and Damien Hirst and their dealers, Eigen and Art and White Cube, can probably rest easy.
Well, I'm sure any gallery is happy when a member of the Lauder family rocks up at their front door.
I'm sure they are.
what's next? What do you have?
Well, a couple of magazines that I'm not so familiar with, which is always nice to see. One of them is called Elephant, which is a magazine I don't know very well. It says it's issue 8, so I'm guessing it hasn't been going very long. It's the complete opposite of the art newspaper. It's extremely glossy. It's full of interviews with the artists. Not much analysis, but it's actually very well done, I think, I have to say. I think it's got lots of good pictures. If you don't know these artists' work, you'll get a very good flavour from it. And they do seem to have generally picked quite articulate artists, because some artists are impenetrable.
I'm glad you can say that. And you can say it with authority as well.
No, I mean, all of us that went through art school and went through cultural theory courses at art school can tell you confidently that there is an awful lot of mishmashed rubbish, you know, half-baked sociology, half-baked art theory that gets recycled in the art world.
Good. Well, I think you might have heard that here first, in fact. Actually, probably over the last couple of weeks, a couple of people have picked up Elephant and also the edition before as well. And I think there's something that people respond to, I think, as you said, from a production value point of view. I think this is something which really goes in another direction. And it's probably, you know, it's complementary to what you do. You would want to have both.
I think that sometimes we forget that there is a really, that obviously is a hugely growing interest, not just in contemporary art, but we hope it will trickle through to, you know, older art as well. There's really quite an educational role for the press still to play, I think.
What about the name Elephant? Where does that come from, and how important is the title to a magazine?
I've absolutely no idea. Is it the elephant in the room?
I think it must be because I think it also goes back to the overpriced artist, isn't it? You think, oh my God, no one wants to talk about it when they're in someone's sort of grand salon, but oh God, do they really get stuffed for that painting?
Yeah. A lot of people do talk about it once they've had a few.
Yeah,
I was going to say,
or once they're back in the car heading home. And you brought Apollo as well.
Yes. Now this is a very different kind of magazine entirely. It's a very august magazine. It's been published for years and years and years.
London-based as well.
Yeah. It focuses on more traditional art. It's gone through a bit of a facelift. It's got a relatively new editor, Oscar Humphreys, and he's definitely given it a bit of a facelift. And in this edition, he's very much focusing on the awards for 2011. So there is an acquisition of the year, which I am delighted to see, is the British Museum's Nimrod Ivories. They're absolutely fantastic pieces, and if you get a chance, go and see them. It's a completely different style of magazine to Elephant. It talks a lot about why a particular painting is important, and it's going back to paintings. I'm looking here at one from 1480s. So again, if you're interested in learning a bit about older art, this is, again, quite an educational magazine, actually.
Where did the editor come from, and how do you think he's moving along?
Well, he actually came from the trade. I mean, he worked for Timothy Taylor.
Timothy Taylor, exactly.
Yeah, worked for Timothy Taylor. He's got very good connections, obviously, into the commercial world. And I think that Apollo always sat slightly oddly. It's not as academic as the Burlington, but it did have an academic feel to it. Mm. And I don't think they want to lose that, and I don't think he is losing that, but I think they're also bringing it a little bit more newsy, a little bit more aware of the market.
But not competition for you. Complimentary.
No, I mean, I remember
when... But you pay attention.
Yeah, no, we definitely look at it. I mean, the editor-in-chief... she's our executive editor on the board. Anna Summers Cox actually used to edit Apollo, so
right.
We're very aware of Apollo. No, we look at it closely, but it's a different style of journalism to us.
Just on something like Apollo, I mean, how much does that travel? I mean, you talked about sort of, you know, let's say they're a little bit more narrow, focusing on more traditional art. But is it really still a UK play, or is it something that also somebody would want to pick up if they were in Hong Kong or if they were in, you know, New York or San Francisco?
I think like us, I mean, actually Oscar told me that their readership is pretty similar to ours, roughly a third UK, roughly a third US, mostly New York, and then a third the rest of the world. I think like us, although we do have a New York office, I think most people can see that our roots are in England.
Mm.
And I think we're all trying to overcome that to a large degree, because the art world is very international. And, you know, it really doesn't matter whether a Botticelli is in, well, it matters in some senses, but, you know, a Botticelli is a Botticelli, whether it's in London or in Paris or New York. So I think we're all trying to get slightly expand from our home bases.
And just finally, before we go, we've got about a minute left. How hard is the push right now for all things digital, even with what you do? Because there's something so wonderful and tactile about what you're doing versus...
Well, we know that our website is not really as good as it should be. So there's a lot of pressure for us to compete in the digital world. I love print, but I do appreciate that the world is turning.
I think the big project for 2012 then is to definitely go completely daily, I think, and give us as much print as possible. Jane Morris, editor of the Art Newspaper, thanks very much. That's all for this Saturday edition of the Review here on Monocle 24. I'm back with the Weekly with my colleagues Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound tomorrow. But for now, for me and Gillian, and also our producer Marcus Hippie, it is a goodbye from Studio One here at Midori House in London. The news headlines are next right here on Monocle 24.